This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The anti-war movement is growing. Last Saturday, demonstrations in Washington, San Francisco, and other cities protested against a U.S. war with Iraq. We're going to look at this new movement. My first guest is Todd Gitlin. He has logged many miles at peace demonstrations over the years. He was president of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, from 1963 to 64, and was active in the movement against the war in Vietnam. He wrote about political protests in his book, The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage. His book, Media Unlimited, How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives, is now out in paperback. His book, Letters to a Young Activist, will be published in the spring. Gitlin is against a U.S. war with Iraq and is hoping a strong peace movement develops, but he has reservations about the group that organized Saturday's peace march in Washington, the ANSWER Coalition. ANSWER stands for Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. Gitlin says this group represents the bitter end orthodoxy of the old left. I asked him about his thoughts on the march and its organizers.
Well, this is complicated. Movements are sloppy and diffuse. And in general, one prefers them that way. That is, people who are small d Democrats don't like the sort of hierarchical command program that authoritarians embrace and find it easy to organize. Now, what that means de facto is that the organizations that are quickest to organize national demonstrations are the ones that are most hierarchically organized, and International ANSWER is one of them. So they get their fustest. They don't have complicated positions. They have simplistic positions, and they're in place like an army to follow orders and put demonstrations on the calendar.
What do you know about this group?
Their steering committee is made up of various left-wing factions, very far left-wing factions that probably total 100 members in America. The best known of them is something called the International Action Center, which is represented by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's a supporter of Slobodan Milosevic, who's a supporter of Saddam Hussein, who's a supporter of the Chinese government at Tiananmen Square. These are people with very freakish and wrongheaded positions. I mean, really appalling positions. Of course, very few people who attend these rallies have any idea of this, or for that matter, care.
Are there certain issues that ANSWER brings to the peace movement that make you uncomfortable, that you don't think belong in the peace movement?
Well, their down-the-line support for releasing Mumia Abu-Jamal, who may well deserve a fair trial, I don't know about that, but is a convicted cop killer. This has no place whatsoever in this movement. Sort of Israel is all wrong, Palestinians of all sorts are all right, has no business in this coalition. And that's the baggage they're bringing to the party.
What are your concerns about how the leadership of the ANSWER Coalition will affect the peace movement?
Well, this is difficult. Many people felt as early as October that since they were committed to opposing the war, and ANSWER was the group that was promoting the demonstration, that they should go and at least take a look. I was in touch with some people who went to ANSWER-sponsored demonstrations, didn't like what they saw and heard, and fled. I think many more people, when it came to January and war had become more in prospect, did decide to enter into the ANSWER coalition, in effect, but without signing on to their principles, and wanted to go and carry their own signs. Opposing unilateral war at this point is a mainstream American position. I've looked at a lot of polls. In general, about a third of the population supports unilateral war in the absence of an immediate threat to America. this is actually an enormous opportunity for an anti-war movement, because you don't have to be left-wing. You don't even have to be left of center. One of the major sites opposed to the war, antiwar.org, has a libertarian sponsorship. There are many Republicans, Heartland people aren't especially political at all, who actually are interested in turning out against the demonstration. So I think it is fruitless, in fact, counterproductive, to organize a sort of left-wing self-celebration jamboree. You'll offend a lot of people who should be opposed to the war, and you're not going to elicit the support of mainstream politicians.
Are you afraid that some of the issues and groups that the Answer Coalition is involved with will be used by some people to discredit the peace movement? I'm thinking, for instance, of Answer's affiliation with the Workers' World Party, its affiliation with other communist groups.
I am concerned that International Answer walks out to the speaker's platform wearing a big sign that says, discredit me. And that those who don't have the interests of a decent and sensible and majoritarian anti-war movement can swat the movement as a whole by pointing the finger at these absurd and reprehensible positions.
Do you feel like you're a member of of HUAC during the McCarthy era when you say this? You're discrediting them because of their communist affiliations.
No, I think that they're actually dishonest in not wanting to own up to their politics. My view in the 60s was that there should be an ecumenical anti-war movement. SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, organized the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War in 1965 with a very minimal position. You know, the war is bad for Vietnam. It's bad for Americans. It should be stopped, period. And we were the sole sponsor. We invited other people to come, and if they want, carry our own signs. But we were ecumenical. We did not do what Answer does. We did not fill the platform with left-wing sectarians.
Now, you were the head of SDS for a while. You were president of SDS. Mm-hmm. And SDS was a pretty radical group that endorsed pretty radical actions. And many of the more mainstream people in the anti-war movement in the 60s thought that SDS was going too far and that it would alienate the mainstream and was therefore not good for the movement. So do you feel like you're in a funny spot now, saying that there's some kind of like too far out on a limb issues involved with the peace movement now?
Well, when I was head of SDS, it was not far out on a limb. I mean, we were against the Vietnam War, but we were not, we were not embracing Ho Chi Minh or the cause of Third World Revolution. SDS went that way, and that was catastrophic, and I opposed it. My only regret is that I didn't oppose it strenuously or successfully enough. There's an awful paradox about the 1960s that today's activists must face. And it is that as the war in Vietnam became less popular, so did the anti-war movement. And the anti-war movement became less popular because it was seen as, first of all, ultra-militant, and secondly, anti-American. Much of the charge of anti-Americanism was undeserved. I mean, after all, if you had a demonstration of 100,000 people and 10,000 of them were carrying American flags, but, 100 of them were carrying Viet Cong flags and one of them was burning a U.S. flag, you know what would have ended up on the evening news that night. But the tragedy of the 60s is that while I think the anti-war movement did retard the extension of the war, the movement itself committed harakiri by isolating itself at the margins of American life and insulting most of the people who themselves were opposed to the war, who were, in fact, the proverbial mainstream people.
So you're critical of the Answer Coalition, which organized the march, the anti-war march on Saturday. Does that take away for you from the success of the demonstration and its turnout?
The turnout is a vote of confidence in the anti-war position. And, the turnout was immense, striking, understood as such by the mass media, which had actually been belittling the movement before that. And I think it's important to understand that these demonstrations, especially the one in Washington, are only moments in the anti-war movement. I mean, there were demonstrations. I've been seeing listservs to send out the word. Somebody from Santa Barbara wrote to a friend of mine that there were 5,000 demonstrators in Santa Barbara last Saturday. In a town in Maine with a population of 1,600, there were 60 demonstrators, 6-0, in the freezing cold against the war. These are not answer supporters. There's now the important, very important action of the Catholic bishops, of the National Council of Churches, opposed to unilateral war. There's the Move On group that has collected vast numbers of signatures on petitions. The Chicago City Council, which is not a bastion of the sectarian left, voted 46-1 against unilateral war. A very sophisticated resolution, by the way, that unlike the answer spokesman acknowledges that Saddam Hussein is a vicious tyrant. So the demonstrations are the easiest things to notice. They get our attention. But I think this is actually a genuinely mass movement. It's happening in little places. It's in this way reminiscent of the American anti-war movement against Vietnam War circa 1969.
My guest is Todd Gitlin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're devoting today's program to the emerging peace movement. My guest is Todd Gitlin. He was active in the anti-war movement of the 60s and was the head of SDS from 1963 to 64. Do you think that there are certain difficulties organizing today that would be different from the challenges of organizing in the 60s?
Well, this, first of all, let's start with the evident fact that the war is not on, and a movement of anticipation is requires a leap of imagination that the evening news and the daily dose of napalm and burning villages do not. The anti-war movement of the 60s sprang from the civil rights movement's spirit. And so there was already a mood of affirmation on the part of activists. Activists had some experience with getting results. Today's movement is springing from a very different mood, a kind of fatalism, a brooding horror about the future, which is partly a consequence of our recent political history and partly a consequence of September 11th. People are scared and they're less prone to want to oppose an American president of any sort. I think also the erosion of what I would call conventional anti-war politics or ecumenical center/liberal anti-war politics means that the sectarian groups like ANSWER and the International Action Center and people like Ramsey Clark and so on loom large in a way that undermines the tensile strength, the absorptiveness of the movement as a whole.
What would you say to people who are very much opposed to a war against Iraq, but at the same time don't support the agenda of international ANSWER?
I would say do something. Let your conscience tell you where to exercise your intelligence and your conviction. That might be going before your city council or writing letters to the paper. It might be broaching anti-war positions in your organizations. It might mean going to a big demonstration sponsored by somebody like ANSWER and carrying your own signs. It might mean anything that imagination will find congenial. I don't think one size fits all here. But I do think that it is not uncommon, and it is a deep and unswervable truth of political life of all sorts, that you end up in bed with people you'd just as soon not be. One does not have the luxury in political life of choosing all of your allies. That's true for leftists, rightists, centrists, everybody else.
You've attended and spoken at your share of demonstrations. Let me see if I can frame a kind of dilemma of demonstrations, particularly here with the war with Iraq. It's a very complicated issue. Demonstrations aren't necessarily the best place for nuanced discussion. You've got thousands, tens of thousands of people. The people who are actually at the demonstration can usually barely hear what's being said at the podium. People on TV can hear that much better. So how do you think you can still let in a certain amount of nuanced discussion and stay away from just like bumper sticker cliches at a demonstration?
Well, I would always hope that speakers even within a few minutes, can express something of the complexity of the issue, doing something other than simply repeating chants. I think that leaflets can do that. Now websites can do that. There are many opportunities to tell one's opponents that, first of all, one is mindful of their arguments. I think that people who support the war have arguments. I don't think this one is a no-brainer. I think to be concerned about the fate of the people of Iraq is not only nice, it's morally exemplary and mandatory. I think that Saddam Hussein is not about to pounce on America, but no question that he'd like to, and so on and so on. So I think one should be mindful. I think one should always strive to elevate the level of debate and not collapse it into a two legs good, four legs bad. This is a tall order, but I would insist it can be done.
You've probably seen this article. There was an article in the December 8th edition of the New York Times Sunday Magazine by George Packer. Mm-hmm. And I just want to read you an excerpt of it and get your reaction to this. It started off by saying, if you're a liberal, why haven't you joined the anti-war movement? More to the point, why is there no anti-war movement that you'd want to join? And the article goes on to discuss the liberal quandary over Iraq. And Packer writes, he speculates that the war in Bosnia converted a lot of liberals into hawks. He says people who from Vietnam on had never met an American military involvement they liked were now calling for U.S. airstrikes to defend a multi-ethnic democracy against Serbian ethnic aggression. Suddenly, the model was no longer Vietnam. It was World War II. Armed American power was all that stood in the way of genocide. These writers and academics wanted to use American military power to serve goals like human rights and democracy, especially when it was clear that nobody else would do it. They advocated a new role for Americans in the world, which came down to American power on behalf of American ideals. What do you think of that argument, that the war in Bosnia kind of changed the equation for a lot of American liberals and turned them into hawks on some issues like Iraq, that some people who had traditionally been liberals don't oppose war in Iraq? They support overthrowing Saddam Hussein.
I think this is a true statement of what happened. I think that many liberals became selective hawks, emphasis on selective. And I would here add that many of the people who supported use of American force in Bosnia and then in Kosovo, or for that matter in Haiti, also supported it in Afghanistan. The problem is, I think many liberals today, while acknowledging that the sponsorship of the anti-war demonstrations is not, you know, their cup of democracy, don't think that Bush is their cup of democracy either. That is, under present political auspices, it's very hard to imagine that the people who were making policy in the White House, who came to office, let it be said, in a manner that was not exactly a high point in the history of democracy, that they are crusaders for democracy. I think you could well believe when Clinton intervened in Bosnia and Kosovo that he did have the interests of democracy rather than oil companies or arms manufacturers in mind. But I think the general statement that you read from George Packer's argument is accurate.
Do you think that that's affecting the type of organizing that's being done around the anti-war movement now?
Well, we see some people who think that the U.S., whose slogan might as well be U.S. out of everywhere. They think that it's unimaginable that American force could ever have a just rationale or a good consequence. I'm obviously not one of those people. I dare say that most people who are opposed to war in Iraq are not pacifists, do not think that American military force is automatically the worst alternative in a situation, but are persuaded that the interests of a democratic revival in the world or extension in the world are not served by an American expedition, which can't even persuade our allies that there is a just cause. I mean, there are many people, not just liberals, who I think are walking into an anti-war movement which they're in the process of manufacturing, whether it's voting in behalf of an anti-war resolution in the Chicago City Council or demonstrating hither and yon.
What do you think an anti-war movement needs to do now to actually be effective in stopping or limiting a war against Iraq?
I think it needs to resort to a panoply of legitimate tactics ranging from lobbying members of Congress to getting resolutions out of city and state assemblages to working within churches and synagogues and so on. I think they need to do wholehearted and intellectually respectable and morally complex work to establish that they or we are the mainstream. I think, in short, it's a moment to establish the immensity of this movement, not to up the militancy, as some would argue, but to underscore the normalcy of this commitment, so that those who are in charge, who are reckoning on their political careers, will take note. I wouldn't want to say that this movement is going to have an easy time standing in front of the Bush bulldozer, but there is no alternative than to try.
Todd Gitlin, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Terry.
Todd Gitlin is the author of the book Media Unlimited, which has just come out in paperback. His next book, Letters to a Young Activist, will be published in the spring. Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.